Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle East Studies. I'm James Dorsey, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Lee Chen Sin, together with Jonathan Fulton, co-editor of External Powers and the Gulf Monarchies, a timely analysis of the Gulf's relations with emerging powers in an increasingly multipolar world. Lee Chen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, James.
It's a pleasure. Perhaps we can kick off with you giving a little bit of an intellectual biography of yourself and how you came to edit this book.
Sure. Well, I started off my academic life as someone who was interested in Russia. So when I was in the university in Singapore, I did European studies because I was fascinated with Gorbachev. And so from there, that morphed into a fascination with the Russian transformation and the Russian reforms. And that took me to the university in London, LSE, where I did my thesis again on Russia. And thereafter, I went to Oxford and I had the pleasure, extreme pleasure of working under Dr. Archie Brown. Although Russian oil industry wasn't his thing, he was more keen to work on Gorbachev, but nevertheless, he very kindly took me on. And I did my thesis about the privatization of the Russian oil industry at a time when it was going through gut-wrenching changes. And I was primarily interested in it because of what it said about state-business relations in Russia, about state capture, about the role of business. And so when I came to Zayed University, I found that at that time, about 2006, Russia didn't have a really great global presence at that time. And so being in an oil-rich country like the UAE, I decided to retool a little bit to work on the UAE's energy sector. Obviously, the hydrocarbon industry, but as well, they were going through a time when they were considering the use of nuclear energy. And so I thought that this was quite a perfect match with my oil background in Russia. And therefore, I worked on the UAE's energy industry as well. And by the time a few years later, Russia had strengthened itself. And it was making a bit more impact in the world. So it was actually a perfect marriage of my Russian studies background with my practical secondary research interests in the UAE's energy sector and the UAE's foreign policy that got me starting to think about possibility of work in this area to straddle the two fields. Now, I was very fortunate to have my colleague, Jonathan Fulton, working with me in Zayed University as well. And he comes from a different angle. He had just finished his Gulf China thesis, his PhD work. And so we kind of saw a complementarity there. because there was a lot of work a few years ago being done on how the Gulf was looking outwards to reach out to external powers to try to manage its relations within the Gulf itself with its neighbors. But there was not a lot of work being done about why external powers, external to the region, like, for example, South Korea, India, China, Russia, etc., why were they interested in the Gulf? So looking from an outside in rather than an inside out perspective. And so this is where we got together and decided to do a book on outside looking in. That we contacted a few people that we knew, and voila, the result was the book.
Indeed, and it's a crucial part of the story today. Perhaps we can start off with exactly that. You know, basically, the Gulf states' international relations have expanded significantly as a result of the more assertive policies in the wake of the 2011 Arab popular revolts. That's evident not only in terms of relations with China and Russia, but also other countries. Perhaps you can give us an initial broad overview.
An overview of Gulf relations with external powers or with external powers with the Gulf? Both. Okay, sure. For Gulf external relations, as you know, part of the reason why they've been looking for more external stakeholders, one of the reasons would be that the U.S. potential withdrawal has left them a bit skittish about whether the traditional security anchor for the Gulf region will still be as committed to them. If we recall, under Obama, he did, according to the Gulf perspective, the U.S. did not stand by Hosni Mubarak during the Arab Spring. And that caused them to pause for a bit and think, you know, if the same thing could happen to them. So they've been looking to diversify their security relations in the event that the U.S. does withdraw or even does scale down its security presence. I guess the second reason why the Gulf would be looking for external partners would be a practical one as well, because all of them are pivoting to Asia for a very rational reason that Asia is where growth is. If Europe is where the growth was, Asia is now where the growth is and where the growth will be. So it's only a matter of practicality for them to pivot to Asia. For example, the biggest trading partners that China has is in the Gulf would be Saudi Arabia and the UAE. So it kind of makes sense for them to pivot to Asia. The UAE, for example, sends all of its gas to Japan and has done so for quite a while. So this pivot to Asia makes economic sense. I would say that the third reason why the Gulf is looking for external stakeholders would be the fact that they have certain domestic constituencies to keep happy. For instance, as we are well aware, there is a rift between the Gulf states. On the one hand, the UAE and Saudis against Qatar. And so in the event that gas becomes the new king in the future in the energy markets because of climate considerations, for example, they would not like Qatar to be the prominent, to take advantage of its gas wealth, to play a larger role in the region. Therefore, they would like to try to get more external stakeholders into the Gulf to try to get them, as we like to say, addicted to oil, which UAE and Saudi has, but Qatar doesn't have as much. And so in this way, they're trying to also use external stakeholders to play a regional game. So I would say that finally, they would also like to engage the external stakeholders, because the external stakeholders themselves have expressed an interest to go out to the Gulf, so to speak. For example, China, obviously with its Belt and Road Project, has an interest in interacting more with the Gulf. Russia, with its newly modernized army and with its increasing capabilities, also would like to go out and make itself more of a global power. And the same can be said for South Korea, which has a little bit more global ambitions. So the external stakeholders are also receptive to overtures from the Gulf. So that would be my perspective, or Jonathan's and my perspective, of why the Gulf is interested in engaging with the other external stakeholders.
All of this leads me to what I think is one key aspect of all of this, and you've tangentially touched on it, and that is that the expansion of international relations is not only due to the Gulf states' greater assertiveness, but also changes in the oil market and what that has meant or is meaning for OPEC. The emergence of the United States as a major oil producer and exporter, greater demand in Asia, and the fact that OPEC agreements to be effective need to be the backing of non-OPEC producers like Russia. They can no longer do it on their own.
Yes, definitely. So it's not just about, you know, international relations, as you pointed out. I think international political economy is crucial as well in explaining the new motivations from both sides. So as you pointed out, with the UAE, with Saudi Arabia, they can no longer control or have an influence on oil markets on their own. And that is why we have this new concept, if you like, called OPEC Plus, which is, you know, the OPEC Plus Russia. But it's not the first time, I have to say, it's not the first time that OPEC has tried to come to some sort of an agreement with Russia to try to stabilize or influence global oil markets. They have tried several times in the past to come to some kind of a cooperative arrangement, but in the past it has always failed. It failed because mostly Russia did not hold up its end of the bargain, but this time around, Russia has seen fit to actually cooperate with OPEC, and I think this is largely because it's also being hammered by U.S. sanctions. So definitely the international political economy explains quite a lot of this interaction between the Gulf and external powers. But I would also like to say two other points about the international political economy having an effect on relations. And that comes, first of all, from the Gulf states itself. They are very keen these days to diversify their economy away from oil, away from gas. Yes, I admit we have heard this before in the 1980s. We heard this in the 1990s as well. But I think that this time they are really serious about diversifying the economy away from a hydrocarbon-based economy for several reasons. For one, oil fields don't last forever. And for some of these countries, they are down to about 30 to 50 years left of oil production at the moment. So they have to make hay while the sun shines. And for example, they also have got increasingly, they also find it increasingly difficult to extract the oil that is left in the reservoirs, because the oil is, you know, deeper down and it's becoming more difficult to extract. You need more well maintenance procedures, etc. You need advanced oil recovery methods by injecting gas or carbon dioxide into the fields to keep the pressure up, etc. So they see that they need a lot of outside expertise to tackle these kinds of challenges. It is no longer the easy oil extraction of the past. So that's why they also need to engage these external stakeholders. So there are these kinds of considerations that's going on that, as you say, you know, explains part of why the two sides are coming together.
I would assume that there's also one other more recent consideration, and that's the move in the U.S. Congress, the NOPEC move. In other words, the move to condemn OPEC as a cartel. And how much does that impact all of this?
Well, of course, Trump, I like the way that you said that it was NOPEC. Trump would like OPEC to keep on turning on the gas taps so that prices of oil and gas, by extension, are kept low. So that keeps his constituencies happy and that keeps them voting for him. That is, of course, a consideration as well. Because even though the U.S. is a big oil producer, what happens to prices and supply in the rest of the world also impacts upon the U.S., even though it's a big oil producer. So that is clearly another consideration. And that is definitely something that's on top of the minds of the U.S.
The forging of closer ties by countries like China, Russia, Japan, Korea, Brazil, or India was also facilitated by the United States defense umbrella in the Gulf that, as for all practical matters, came at no expense to other external powers who were interested in engaging more deeply with the Gulf states.
Yes, that is extremely true. The U.S. in the past has taken on this burden without expecting any like commitments from its allies to ensure that the sea lanes, that they keep the sea lanes free for navigation, and they protect the sanctity of the maritime borders. And this is usually not really recognized by quite a lot of people, but the U.S. does play a huge role in this. I think it's something like they spend around 50 to 70 billion U.S. dollars alone just with their commitments to this region. And that helps to, that means that external stakeholders who want to trade with the Gulf do not have to worry about, you know, potential threats to maritime trade. And so they're basically, as Trump would like to say, free riding off the U.S. strength. Now, the U.S. has what we call an amazing command of the global commons. It's not that no one can challenge the U.S. in the global commons, but that the U.S., more than any other power, has a preponderance of power, of dominance in the sea, in the air, on land, and that they are able to prevent other powers from coming into the region. It's true that they cannot stop all challenges, for example, in Afghanistan, etc., but they do have a preponderance of this power. If you think about it, Russia is actually quite happy for the U.S. to continue this role, especially here in the Gulf. Russia has got, you know, no intention and certainly no capability at the moment to replace the U.S. And indeed, it's the U.S. security umbrella here that Russia benefits from in terms of security of trade and security of investments with the Gulf states. Similarly with China, yes, even though it has, I think it's two aircraft carriers now, but again, power projection is pretty limited, perhaps beyond the South China Sea. So even if you look at India, yes, it is thought of as a possible rising external power who could play a security role in the Gulf. And it does have ambitions to play this role. But equally, there are domestic constituencies in India who would like India to concentrate more on its resources on much needed reforms within India itself. So wherever you look, it seems like the U.S., well, everybody would like the U.S. to stay, including, of course, the Gulf states. But still, they have to prepare for the worst case scenario in case the U.S. withdraws. But frankly, personally, I do not see the U.S. just, withdrawing from the region completely. It's got too much of a stake here in terms of trade, investment, energy. Its allies have too much of a stake here. It needs to ensure, its prosperity is not affected, that the prosperity of its allies is not affected. So I don't see a complete U.S. withdrawal, although, of course, I can appreciate that they would like their allies to help somewhat in burden sharing, showing up a little bit more often when there are anti-piracy operations, etc.
The book essentially argues that the Gulf's relations with all of these countries are primarily economic or military in terms of weapons sales and secondary support for the U.S., like in the case of the British and French military bases in the region. The one external power you haven't mentioned is Turkey, which granted is perceived by many as a Middle Eastern power, but which for the longest period of time, and still in many ways, sees itself as a European power. So the question is whether what category you would put Turkey in, and given Turkey's presence in alliance with Qatar, whether it's an exception to the rule.
Yes, it's true that, as you mentioned, the bulk of relations are about oil and gas and also somewhat about weapon sales. Now, while that is true, that is for the present moment. And that's because of, the fact that in the Gulf states, they have not undertaken till now a lot of economic diversification strategies. So there is quite limited trade complementarity between the Gulf and the rest, except for exchange of energy and weapons. But I would suggest that if the Gulf states continue along the path of economic diversification, particularly into non-energy sectors, for example, to non-hydrocarbon sectors, for example, nuclear energy, space, renewable energy, chemicals, petrochemicals, etc., that there will be lots and lots of opportunities opening up. And indeed, many have opened up as well. From Brazil, the Gulf states are importing food, for instance. So as they diversify, I think more of such opportunities will open up. As to your second point about Turkey as the other external power, yes, it is external to the Gulf region per se, which is why we have included it in the book. And Turkey's position, again, is an interesting one because of its relations with Qatar and its impact upon the Gulf feud that we talked about earlier. So this would be an interesting case of seeing, whether the Gulf states would be able to, shall I say, entice Turkey to move away from its relations with Qatar. Now, why I say that could be interesting to watch is because the Gulf states have previously tried to do this, for example, with Russia. In the past, they have tried to entice Russia away from its support of Bashar al-Assad in Syria by offering Russia, offering to buy weapons from Russia, offering to make some investments in Russia. These enticements and inducements were not successful for the most part. But in the case of Turkey, who knows, this could be successful. So it's an example of the Gulf states trying to use Turkey, trying to entice Turkey to manage inter-Gulf rivalries. So this is definitely something that would be really interesting to watch.
The ever greater engagement by external powers in the region means also that they have mushrooming interests, like in the case of China, that has sparked the need to be seen to be protecting their own nationals as well as their assets. The question is, how long are countries like China or Russia going to be willing to rely on the United States that in many ways is perceived under the Trump administration to have become far more unreliable, and or to what extent is that something that's also going to be domestically acceptable? We've seen in China various instances where the fact that the Chinese were not prepared in the case of an emergency, that has sparked domestic dissent.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really good question on, you know, to what extent they are going to keep trying, to dampen down on the security role, given their increased economic interests. We should note that in China, for instance, they have had their nationals being attacked. And I believe that it was in Africa and Sudan. And so with the ever-increasing amount of Belt and Road projects in and around the Gulf, let's say even in Pakistan, the Chinese, in order to protect these investments, may even feel that there is a need to establish some kind of a base, maybe here in the Gulf, so as to protect their Belt Road interests that skirts the Gulf region, and also in Oman. So this is something that it's definitely worth watching. Although at this point in time, for the Chinese, their conception of security is what we call, is what we call security through development. So they are trying to explain away the fact that if we help these countries develop, that will in turn make them more cooperative, and because there's development, so there are less ethnic or other kinds of hostilities, which will therefore increase security for the Gulf states as well as for China. So that's their concept of security through development, and that is their current approach. Certainly, in the long run, they have also calculated that they may need to take a more traditional approach to security, i.e. Military security. And I think that's why they have been increasing their military spending in absolute numbers. Trying to build their own aircraft carriers. They have also tried to develop their own weapons systems, their own plane, their own fighter jets. They have actually borrowed quite a lot of technology, and borrowed in inverted commas, through their imports from Russia. They're now able to develop their own weapon systems and their own fighter jets. So I think that they are in the process of preparing for a larger military security role, most likely in the South China Sea, but I don't think you can discount them taking a larger military presence here because of the Belt and Road projects. As for Russia, I think that for Russia, the Gulf is not a key region for them. For Russia, their main interlocutor has always, their main reference point has always been Europe. So if there were to be a bigger military presence, it would be the Russians in a European setting rather than in the Gulf, which is really not a key area for them. Even though they seem to be very active here, but trade-wise and investment-wise, and in terms of a reference point of development, Russia has always seen itself as European at best, Eurasian in a pinch, but definitely the Gulf has not, you know, been the main focus or their main area of their main target area.
Despite the rebalancing, the global rebalancing of power that we're witnessing, talk of a new world order, and the book's reference to omnibalancing, in which a Gulf state decides which external power can protect the regime's interests best, accepted wisdom is that no one state will be able to replace the U.S. as the region's protector in the near future, at least. So what does that mean if at some point, certainly a country like China feels that it needs to be more assertive in the protection of its interests?
Well, I think these days we are getting in the Middle East to be in a situation of what we called in the book liquid alliances. Alliances are more fragile, are more liquid. They tend to change shape and form. And alliances are no longer on a whole basket of interests as in the past, but alliances are formed more on a specific issue-driven alliance. I'll give you an example. If we take the Gulf, Gulf's relations with Russia, the Gulf were very happy to approach Russia over cooperation in the oil markets. But this did not mean that the Gulf was happy with Russia's position in Syria. As another example, the Gulf are happy to unofficially engage much more with Israel in order to balance off Iran, but that doesn't mean that the Gulf are happy with, you know, Israel's decisions over settlements or over, you know, the capital. And so it is very, very single issue driven in some case, in quite a lot of cases these days. And that is what makes alliances very, very liquid and very changeable. So I think if China were to say, would like to have a increased security presence, I think it would depend on what issue, over what issue specifically. Would it be over, you know, say, protection of the nationals, or would it be on a more terrorist, or would it be on a terrorism angle? If it was on the terrorism angle, I'm pretty sure that a few countries there would not object to a kind of a multilateral cooperation over terrorism, since it affects, you know, all of them. But if it was to come to a single issue-driven thing, like, say, protection of Chinese nationals, then I suppose, you know, it will probably be a bit more, you know, specific, a bit more dicey. But I don't see the U.S. Objecting to Chinese taking a more aggressive position on that.
The book argues basically that the Gulf states cannot see their national security interests independent of other states in the region, particularly the Gulf states. And while that probably was for the longest period true, with Gulf states having similar security interests, I wonder whether that's still valid in the wake of the Gulf crisis and the boycott of Qatar, given one that Qatar is separated from all of this now, but also that there are concerns in Oman and Kuwait with regard to common security interests.
Yes, that is indeed very true. That and that goes to Trump's point about how he would like to have a, you know, a kind of a Gulf NATO, so to speak. But that is really a non-starter. In these days, because the GCC is basically split, as you mentioned, between Saudi Arabia and UAE on one side, Qatar on the other side, and Kuwait in the middle, and of course Bahrain with the Saudis and the Emiratis. So in the times now of a split GCC, clearly, a Gulf NATO concept cannot work. So this begs the issue of whether any of the external powers will then want to take the opportunity to split the GCC apart further, since the GCC has traditionally been seen as an American ally, and so worm their way into the region. Now, it's interesting, say, to look at the Russian angle, because Russian foreign policy traditionally has been, let's be friends with all sides. We will dance at everyone else's wedding, that kind of concept. I'm friends with both Fatah and Hamas. So, but Russia has not actually used the opportunity of the Gulf split to actually drive a wedge in between the GCC states. Russia many times has come out saying that, you know, this is an internal Gulf matter. We are really not interested to muddy the waters. We would just like everything to be solved through negotiations, no military action, etc. So they have been quite keen to stay out on that. And at the same time, the Gulf states themselves have also are very aware that external powers could come into the region this way. And so, for example, they've been quite happy to say this is an internal Gulf issue. You know, it should be solved by ourselves. Even in the case of Syria, the Emiratis have recently come out to say that, this should be, in fact, they've tried to say that this should be an Arab issue, i.e. Iran, please do not play a role. Turkey, do not play a role. They have tried to keep some of these external powers out of these issues, because I think they realize that this could be, kind of like a way in for some of these external powers.
The book argues further that the expansion of South-South trade and investment gives the Gulf states greater opportunity to hedge their bets. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
Sure, I'll be glad to. South-South trade is quite a new thing, because in the past, or let's say in the 20th century, quite a lot of trade was North-South, not just trade, but investments was North-South direction. Recently, of course, there has been South-North investments. For example, in the football clubs in Europe, some of them have been purchased by, Qatar, have been purchased by Abu Dhabi or Dubai. So there has been some South-North investment. But what is quite interesting today is the South-South trade and investment. So, for example, the UAE investing in Africa, etc., these kinds of South-South trades and investments, China in Africa, China in the Gulf, etc. However, I think we should be careful in saying that this is going to be the trend. I think the book makes it quite clear that this is part of a rebalancing, in a sense that not everything is going to be in a North-South or a South-North direction. Because even today, there is the North-South angle is still very, very significant and prominent. And perhaps I could give you an example of, let's say, in the UAE, there is an onshore oil concession, an onshore company called ADCO, which is Abu Dhabi company for onshore oil operations. And in the past, it was owned 60% by Abu Dhabi's ADNOC and 40% by foreign stakeholders. In the past, for foreign stakeholders, there were a lot of what we would consider developed country stakeholders. There was 10% for Total of France, 10% for BP of the UK, 10% for BP, 10% for Shell. France would have 10% as well. Exxon and Mobil, another 5% each. So basically, a lot of the 40% of the foreign stakeholders would be Western companies. That was the old structure. Today, they have renegotiated ADCO's partnership, and the character of that 40% has changed quite a bit, because today only 20% of it is from Western countries, France and the UK. So that's only 20% going to the developed countries. And the other 20% is a really interesting mix of Chinese oil companies, Japanese and South Korean. So yes, while there has been some move, you know, of South-South trade and investment, I think it's just a rebalancing because the Gulf states still need the expertise and the technology of developed countries who have got much more experiencing, for example, with developing tight oil plays, tight gas plays, which is something that they will need if they want to fund their economic diversification. It's a great idea that they get in the Asian stakeholders because that would give them security of demand. So I think while the South-South trade and investment is an interesting angle, we cannot say that, you know, that's the end of the the North-South kind of interaction.
Another point I'd appreciate if you could elaborate on, and that is that in the book, or the book argues that the economic and social reforms that you've described earlier are a way to solidify rentierism and survive, and they are a strategy for regime survival.
Yes. Yes, thank you for the opportunity to explain more about this. So the old, what we call the network of old rentiers, were the rentiers that were based on the hydrocarbon industry, so the oil and gas. In order to tap into the opportunities offered by the new global economy, the Gulf states have also expanded into renewable energy, into nuclear energy, into education, into space. And I think all this is really important because on the one hand, yes, it gives more opportunities, a more balanced development for the UAE, for Saudi Arabia. It gives more opportunities for external stakeholders to take part in this transformation. But equally important, it actually adds to the support system of the Gulf states, because then now you can have a bigger pool from which the rentiers can draw from. No longer just oil and gas rents, but also rents from nuclear, rents from space, rents from renewable energy. And so this is a way, I think, in which to expand the legitimacy among citizens. And don't forget that oil and gas, it is still very, very important, but they always need to keep an eye out for the latest trends so that they can ride on the revenues that these trends provide, get their citizens engaged in this, and therefore be a bulwark of extra support for these kinds of reforms.
The Gulf states are increasingly moving towards alternative energies. That obviously creates significant business opportunities. Yet the book argues that, on the other hand, it will mean that Gulf states will have to go to greater length to attract foreign investments. Why is that?
Well, I think partly because, on the one hand, all the Gulf states, for better or for worse, are kind of using the same economic diversification strategy. It's not just one Gulf state that's doing that, but everyone else has jumped into the picture. The economic diversification plans are basically repetitions of each other. So they will have to work very, very hard to make sure that the foreign investment comes to, say, Kuwait, rather than, say, Saudi Arabia, for example, because the foreign investor has a field of all these countries to choose from. So in that sense, each of the Gulf states has to work harder to differentiate itself and to attract the foreign investment. So that's number one. Number two, the states also have to work harder to attract foreign investment because also in terms of there is only, you know, a limited number of players in renewable, for example, in nuclear. There are only a limited number of players in who can actually build and construct and operate and manage a nuclear plant. And so if they, let's say Saudi Arabia and the UAE want to get into this, they're going to have to, you know, find a way to attract these very, very few energy nuclear reactor construction companies to be able to come into the country and to construct something like, you know, 16 nuclear plants in Saudi Arabia alone. How is one single contractor going to be able to construct 16? Even if it's a staggered timescale, there's cost considerations, there's resource considerations in terms of labor, there are considerations in terms of whether it's sustainable in terms of the human resources available in the Gulf to sustain the knowledge that you need to run and operate these nuclear systems, safety systems, regulatory systems, etc. So for a lot of these reasons, you know, they are going to have to compete actually with each other to be able to attract the needed foreign investment. And on the third point, because all these investments in alternative energy, whether it's renewable or nuclear, require a whole lot of money, a lot of subsidies, a lot of new infrastructure, a lot of human resource training, that just means that they are going to have to keep selling or keep exporting their hydrocarbon resources in order to fund alternative energy development. And that's really a little bit of an irony, that they are going to have to keep developing their oil fields and their gas fields in order to move away from that to go into alternative energy. So again, they're going to have to keep trying to attract investments in oil and gas, which it's not, you know, now with all the shale oil plays in the US, investors are looking to play the shale oil plays there, as well as looking into LNG gas plants in, say, Qatar or in Australia. So investors really have got quite a lot of opportunities to play with in terms of oil and gas. And so that's why the Gulf states, with all this new competition, are also going to have to work much harder to attract the needed oil investments to fund their alternative energy investments.
We've talked a lot about the opportunities that arise from the Gulf states' need to diversify, streamline their economies. That involves, more often than not, a unilateral rewriting of the social contract, which brings with it, of course, social and political risks. And to what degree is that going to be a concern for external powers?
External powers, I think, when they look at the Gulf states, I will comment on the Saudis and the Emiratis, which I'm more familiar with. I think when they look at, say, the UAE, for example, I would say that they probably aren't as concerned as they are about the social impact of these kinds of transformation. I think they see here in the UAE as it's a more stable, there is more consensus here about what needs to be done, about how it's, you know, how it should be done. Because I guess the population here is smaller and it's a little bit easier to control. The government has been very careful in, for example, it's got a direct democracy system, what we like to call the marshalist system of direct democracy, where it, you know, meets very frequently with its constituencies to explain things to them, to hear about their concerns. So in a smaller state, it is a little bit easier to kind of make these gestures to show that, you know, they are listening. They have done away with some of the subsidies, but as well, you know, they have kept quite a lot of them. some of the subsidies are taken away more from the expatriate workers than from the locals. So there is still quite a lot of, co-opting the local population into their vision. So I think if the external stakeholders look at the UAE, I think they would be a bit more comfortable with how the social contract is, you know, going to be renegotiated. On the other hand, I guess if they look at Saudi Arabia, they are probably going to be a little bit uncomfortable because of all the things that have happened recently. But I think it's quite important to look at Saudi Arabia in terms of a segmented kind of population, where you have the younger people, you know, the bulk of the Saudi population, a lot of them are under 30. So you have the younger people who are really, really supportive of some of these more modernizing elements of the reforms, whether it's concerts or whether it's movie theaters, etc. And they have been very supportive of these kinds of moves. And the other segment of the population are the more conservative and traditional elements, which, you know, are in, I wouldn't say they are a very small group, but certainly they are not as big a constituency as the under 30. So I would think that if they look at this picture, they would see and hope, I guess, that the future would be with the younger under 30 people. And that hopefully, you know, they managed to renegotiate the social bargain, and they seem to have, you know, accepted the pace of the reforms in Saudi Arabia. But what is really worrying, or what is going to be a big concern, is whether these reforms, apart from the social ones, whether they are able to generate the main thing, which is jobs, because a lot of these young people are not employed as well. And so whether these social reforms, economic reforms, whether it's that you're able to bring in foreign investments that bring jobs, whether they are able to create new industries that young Saudis can work in, this is the dangerous part of the whole social bargain. So socially, it seems fine, but for the under 30s, but economically, that's still a big question mark over whether, you know, the foreign investors feel that this is going to be a problem or not.
You spoke earlier of, for example, Russia not really having an interest in taking on a larger security role in the Gulf. And that's probably true for many, not all, but many of the external powers currently engaged in the region. The problem, of course, with all of these analyses is, are the black swans. One of those black swans was the killing of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, which has led to certainly a strain in relations between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. Congress. And we still don't know what the fallout of mounting anger in the U.S. Congress is going to do to U.S.-Saudi relations. Could the fallout of a crisis like that change perceptions of countries like Russia in terms of the security architecture?
I think that because the Gulf, just because it is not a key focus of Russian foreign policy, that this kind of fallout, whether they would take advantage of, you know, worsening in U.S.-Saudi relations to worm their way into the region, I mean, yes, of course, they could do it, but they haven't done it in the case of, say, the Gulf Rift between the Saudis, Emiratis and Qatar. So I don't see Russia really taking advantage of any problems with the Saudis and Americans to play a larger security role. I would grant you that Russia would use it as an opportunity, for example, to sell more weapons. And the Gulf states would probably buy more weapons from the Russians, not because they actually need or want the Russian weapons per se, but, you know, it's more of a signaling function to the American Senate, for example, that they have other options. But realistically speaking, even this, whatever weapons they buy from the Russians are just a drop in the ocean. The Gulf states have traditionally bought American weapon systems, and they've bought like, you know, billions and billions of American weapon system. The UAE recently offered to buy about $1 billion worth of Russian weapons, and that's just a drop in the bucket for, you know, the overall spending on American systems. Besides, American and Russian defense systems don't have, they are not interoperable. So you cannot just buy American systems and then, you know, buy some Russian planes and then hope that the Russian planes can speak to the American systems. That doesn't work. There's no interoperability. So for the most part, Gulf systems, defense systems are based entirely on American weapon systems. So if they, you know, do try to buy weapon systems, which they do, which they will, they have wanted to buy S-400s, for example, it could work in certain isolated theaters, let's say, I don't know, maybe in Syria if they wish. It could work in isolated theaters, but if you're talking about the whole defense system throughout the entire country, it is not easy to integrate the different software systems because of proprietary rights. So that's why, you know, I feel that that Russia could well take advantage of this rift to get a bigger foot into the door in terms of security commitments. But I just don't think that the Gulf is important enough for Russia at this point in time.
Li Chen, I have many more questions, but we've already taken up a lot of your time. Perhaps we can conclude with you telling us a little bit about what your future plans are. Where do you go from here in terms of your research?
Well, that's a really good question, and one that Jonathan and I have talked about. And where we see there is a space for future research coming from the book is that while we've talked a lot in the book about external powers and their role in the Gulf, we haven't actually talked about how external powers compete with each other in the Gulf. For example, in terms of the external powers competing on weapon sales in the Gulf, or the various external powers competing on providing cybersecurity services to the Gulf, or external powers competing among themselves to, let's say, provide support for like museums development or cultural development. So we haven't actually looked at the Gulf as a theater of competition among external powers. And this is where we'd actually like to go with, you know, in terms of a future project after this book. So that's our plan. But at the moment, Jonathan is really busy with his projects on the Belt and Road. I myself have a project with Robin Mills on alternative energy in MENA. So, you know, we both have concurrent projects going on, but we hope that maybe in about 1 or 2 years' time, we actually can have the opportunity to work together again to edit a book on the Gulf as a theater of competition for external powers. And I hope you enjoy it too.
Li Chen, thank you very much. Indeed, I enjoy it very much, and it links into stuff that I am doing at the moment. In any case, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoy it and wish you all the best.
James, thank you very much.